On August 28, 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his famous speech entitled, "I Have a Dream." He repeated that phrase, "I have a dream," many times in that speech, painting a picture of an integrated and unified America, the dream for which he longed. In Daniel 2, another king had a dream about the future world which was coming, and he didn't even know what the dream meant, and he was even befuddled about exactly what the dream was. But by the end of chapter 2, he discovered both the dream and its interpretation, but it came through a very difficult struggle. Daniel 2 is a pivotal chapter upon which all prophecy in the Bible hinges. Great care should be taken in its study. Here is seen the temporal, fleeting glory of man and the ultimate triumph of Christ's kingdom. Here is seen also the totality of the times of the Gentiles, a phrase that is used by Christ to describe a dispensational related time period in which Gentile kingdoms would trample over and rule over God's chosen people, Israel. Here is the summary of man's efforts to control the world and to rebel against God. It is quite surprising that God even uses a wicked king as the instrument through whom he is going to reveal this great masterpiece of prophecy. Instead of selecting a wonderful prophet like Daniel, he speaks through a king, a pagan king, an evil pagan king. It seems as though God, by doing so, is saying, "I can use whomever I want to do whatever I want, whenever I want." It's like he says, "I am the king, the real king of the universe, and my kingdom is over all." How quickly the majestic power of great King Nebuchadnezzar shrinks into pitiful minuteness as he becomes a helpless pawn carrying out the plan of God. This great chapter unfolds in a very tense drama. The scenes move back and forth from the king's bedroom to the king's court to Daniel's house and back to the court. Let's pick it up where we see the deathly dilemma in verses 1 through 13. We've already read them. I'm going to move right into the text there where we find, first of all, the king's nightmare in verse 1. Notice the timing of this nightmare. It says, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. So this indicates that this was before Daniel and his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, had been promoted. So we know then that that's one of the reasons perhaps why he didn't consult Daniel before this chapter was over. It is very possible that this was in the third year of Daniel's training, maybe in the second year, before the formal presentation of the four youths to the king in chapter 1:18. And if so, this would explain why Daniel was not consulted before the command for execution. Daniel was still an unknown entity at that time. He had not been promoted in the political ranks of wise men, and no one would have thought to bring him in for this very important meeting with the king. So that's the timing. Notice the trouble. Verse 1 describes a very difficult time in the life of this king. You notice what it says, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams, not just one time, but perhaps many times. Have you ever had a recurring nightmare? Sometimes children talk about nightmares they have and growing up, and it's a repeated nightmare. This was a repeated nightmare. I'm telling you, I think this king was probably desperate not to go to sleep at night. He says, here comes the nightmare again. It says that not only did it go, he had these dreams, but it says his spirit was troubled And his sleep went from him. He couldn't sleep. It was so alarming and so amazingly scary to this king. His spirit was troubled. He may have experienced depression and been very irritable. Sleep orders abound today. Many people exist with troubled spirits and suffer from insomnia. This guy had a major case of insomnia and of a depressed spirit because of this dream. God was working this man over big time. So that's the king's nightmare, which soon turned into the wise men's nightmare. In verses 2 through 12, there's a call for interpretation. Verse 2, he calls him in. His first attempt to find a solution is not much different from what people do today. He consulted with his leading counselors, human counselors with man-concocted programs and demon-inspired practices will always fall short of satisfactory solutions. And people do that today. They have problems in their lives and they immediately call a counselor and they don't always check to see if it's a biblical counselor. Sometimes Christians do that. And people go to sometimes demonic counselors. And so there is a call for interpretation. Notice the credentials and identification of this group of people that he goes to for counsel. In verse 2, he calls the magicians and the astrologers, the sorcerers and Chaldeans, and he talks about these. These four groups that are listed in verse 2 are four different classes of wise men, which are referred to frequently in the book. These men were powerful in the Babylonian kingdom, having great influence even upon the king himself. The magicians, for example, comes from a root word in the Hebrew meaning stylus or pen, and therefore may show their connection with scholarship. These were the PhDs and the education gurus of their day. These scholars became involved with divination, the art of forecasting the future. Other connections with this group may have included the occult, rituals, exorcism, witchcraft, sorcery, and a general claim to supernatural powers. No wonder Nebuchadnezzar turned to them and said, "Come on and help me with this." The second group in that verse is the astrologers, may also be translated enchanters. It refers to the power of necromancy or communications with the dead. These also claim to receive special information from the stars with peculiar attention given to the future. It was a form of superstition. You may recall that when King Saul, at the end of his life, was so desperate to know the future, he called in a witch and had her contact the dead. And she was able to do that. She was able to contact and call up Samuel, the prophet. And this was a group that included contacting the dead, something that we ought not to do. The sorcerers was the third group, who were also practicing incantations and witchcraft. They were a religious group that used herbs and charms and various potions. They were considered to be in league with evil forces. And so it's your classic look at the witch and what she's doing and those incantations and so on. This was that group. By the way, witchcraft isn't just reserved only for ladies or, you know, women. It could be men that are involved in witchcraft. And then the final group was called the Chaldeans there in verse 2, referred to an ethnic group, sometimes but more often to a class of religious priests and wise men. They were usually known to be connected with astrology, again, seeking the future. And so these are the credentials and the identification of these groups. Now let's look at their consultations and their intercessions in verses 3 through 7. There's an expectation by Nebuchadnezzar. He explains in verse 3, "I've dreamed a dream, and my spirit's been troubled. And I want you to tell me what the interpretation of this dream is." And so they respond, and their professional response in verse 4, "O king, yeah, live forever. Tell us the dream, and we'll give you the interpretation." You know, I just feel like I could probably, you know, handle that part too. I mean, I can do as good as those guys could. You give me your dream. You guys tell me your dream, and I'll give you some interpretation of it. It might not be God's interpretation, but it'll be an interpretation. One guy years ago that went to a charismatic school, he began to question whether or not the people that were speaking in tongues were really, you know, they would speak in chapel, they would speak in tongues, and then somebody would stand up and give the interpretation of that because they were trying to do it the biblical way. So this guy with his roommate says, you know what, we got to find out if they really know what they're talking about. And he says, my roommate knew a little bit. He was Jewish, and he knew a little bit of Yiddish. And he says, I want you to get up in chapel tomorrow and act like you were speaking in tongues and do Yiddish. So he got up and he gave the 23rd Psalm. He quoted it in Yiddish. And everybody said, wow, isn't that wonderful? God is speaking to us again through speaking in tongues. And he sat down and he waited. And finally, one of the gals that seemed to get up a lot and give these interpretations, she stood up and she said, you know, God's upset with the dating relationships on this college campus. And that's the interpretation of this dream and this speaking. He wants the guys and gals to get more in line with God's dating plan. And the roommate, and they looked at each other and said, not from God. And these guys were not any better than that. They had some kind of idea of what to say, but it wasn't God's interpretation. So Nebuchadnezzar, he is exasperated with them. In verse 5, notice what he says in verse 5. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the thing is gone from me. I don't know what the dream is anymore. If you don't make known the dream itself and the interpretation, I'm going to cut you in pieces and burn your houses. He's exasperated. Nebuchadnezzar, I think, is sick and tired of their professional formulas and empty solutions. His disgust boils over. Mount St. Helens is about to blow her top. You get the sense from this response that the king had many dealings with these quacks and never found satisfactory help. So he resorts to extortion. In verse 6, he says, great reward if you do it, and the ultimate if you don't. You give me the right interpretation of the dream, and you will be rewarded and honored greatly. If you don't, you're dead. If any of them had an answer, he knew for sure how to appeal to them to get it out. The double appeal usually worked wonders. Death if you don't, great honor if you do. The greatest threat and the greatest reward. Their explanation, notice in verse 7, they answered again and said, let the king tell his servants the dream, we'll show the interpretation. They appealed to his good judgment and his common sense. Give us the facts and we will interpret. From our point of view, that's logical. But the king was in no mood to be logical at that moment. So we see a charge of ineptness here in verses 8 and 9. An amazing charge in verse 8 and 9. He says, the king answered and said, I know of a certainty you would gain the time because you see the things. You're just stalling for time. He says, I know what you're going to do, verse 9. You'll make known unto me the dream, but there is one decree for you. For if you've prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me, you're not going to tell me the thing. You don't know. You're just making up something. You're stalling. Perhaps planning to make up a story since I can't remember my dream. The accuses the wise men of attempting to buy some time, gain the time, so as to formulate a plan of action. Now keep this in mind because we're going to hear this stall tactic again in a few moments. They're trying to buy time. They may have planned to fabricate a story claiming that they knew the dream which the king had. Of course they couldn't tell for sure whether the king had actually forgotten the dream or was just testing them. Some scholars believe Nebuchadnezzar did not lose the dream, or that he at least still recalled enough of it to be able to recognize a true accounting of it. At any rate, he was not willing to accept just any old snow job from these guys. He wanted clear proof that whoever interpreted the dream had a divine source behind the ordinary. He says, you are full of lying and corrupt words. That is a powerful statement, folks. You might circle that phrase, because I tell you what, whoever does not teach and preach the Bible today is full of corrupt and lying words. The king's charge against these hell-inspired counselors was not only accurate, but also reveals the common character of all humanistic counsel today. It is a decorated system of prepared, lying, and corrupt words. That is why Christians today should avoid the world's counselors. They are the father, like their father, the devil, and will lie just like he does in John 9:8:44. But the Bible tells us, blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinner, nor sitteth in the seat of scornful. But in other words, the concept is you will be wise if you listen to the counsel of the godly and the counsel that comes from his word. So verses 8 and 9, the stage is being prepared for God's entrance here. He will come when human possibilities are exhausted. A test is being constructed to show the limitations of man-made wisdom. And that is so critical, especially when we look to the future. When we want to know what's coming in the future, don't look to man. You have to look to God. Man does not know, and the devil does not know. And so these guys tell us this is a crazy impossibility, verse 10 and 11. He says, the guys tell him the wicked counselors were worried and desperate. They spoke the truth here. They're telling the truth here. Nebuchadnezzar's request indeed was rare. There was not a man on the earth that could reveal the king's matter. Their final observation statement is extremely interesting. Do you see what they say there? There is no other that can reveal it before the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. We don't know of any human, any gods that on earth with man that dwells with man. It was an admission on their part that even with their claims to supernatural powers, this test was too much. The limit to their powers had been discovered. Suddenly, all the pomp and glory of their wicked practices seemed to fade. Their gods were limited. They were exposed as frauds in partnership with the limited powers of hell. And I would say, not only are they the limited powers of hell, they are the limited powers of hell that are also evil and wicked and troubling. So look at verse 12, the command from infuriation. This guy is just furious right now. He says the king is angry and furious. The whole issue was obviously troubling to the king greatly. He became livid with rage, very furious. He didn't just kick the dog and slam the door. He apparently came to some kind of conclusion that all the spiritual advisors and counselors in his court were frauds. He had been a fool to allow their errant theology to permeate Babylon. He suddenly became sick of all religious leaders and he wanted them out of his sight. In fact, he wanted them permanently out of his life and kingdom. His unique position of power, by the way, enabled him to vent his fury in a vengeance of slaughter. Execution was commanded. Kill them all. This command was not an uncommon event, by the way, in Babylon. This tyrant king had the absolute power to slay whomever he wished. And he did it like some of the tyrants that are on planet Earth today. For example, last September, on September 5th, the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un ordered 30 officials to be executed over their alleged failure to prevent massive flooding and landslides in the summer that resulted in the deaths of some 4,000 people. He blamed them and he killed them. This is just one occasion from a ruthless dictator who executes people in North Korea fairly often, for example, and for seemingly senseless reasons, as if those 30 people could stop the flooding. Really? And so this seems to be indicative of an imbalanced and mentally unstable power monger. Another report stated over 300 people have been publicly executed by this same dictator since he came to power in 2011. Other reports indicate they believe that there are many more which cannot be documented because of the careful security which is applied to these events. But people that escape out of there have been telling the stories, and they're not pretty, they're ugly. This is the kind of dictator that Nebuchadnezzar was. And he was angry, and he says, kill them all those religious leaders. So the king's nightmare became the wise men's nightmare, and then it became Daniel's nightmare too. Look at verse 13. Verse 13, and the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain also. This whole issue was just a big nightmare. Daniel and his fellows were sought. Though they had not yet been consulted, they were considered one of the brands of religious counselors or wise men, and so they were sought for execution. Is it panic time? Is it time to run and hide? How would you respond to this crisis moment? It isn't fair. Daniel and his friends were completely different from the sham religious imposters. But the king could not see that reality at that moment. It would take a miraculous event to expose that distinction, and that's what will come. So the deathly dilemma is before us. Let's move on now to the diplomacy of Daniel, because this is where the story turns. The marvelous diplomacy of Daniel. By the way, the word diplomacy is a good word. Just think about this definition for a moment. It means skill in conducting relations between nations or people and making agreements. Somebody used the word also tact. This guy was a master of tact. When King Nebuchadnezzar went on a rampage, the whole city became a flurry of nervous activity. No one knew how to appease this king. It would take a diplomatic genius. The king was indeed about to become acquainted with such a genius. This exciting drama shows young Daniel in one of his finest hours and unveils the secret to his diplomatic greatness. It involved three basic elements: wisdom, worship, and witnessing, all for God, and we'll see how they show out. Let's look at those one at a time. First of all, Daniel shows his diplomacy through showing wisdom in verses 14 to 18. Verse 14, then Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. By the way, that word there in verse 14, the captain of the king's guard, literally could be the executioner of the king, that the king used. So here, the executioner is coming to gather up all of the wise men, and he's not by himself, no doubt. He's got an army with him, and they're collecting all these guys and saying, come on, you know what the king's order is. Sorry, but you're going to die. So Daniel shows wisdom in responding to a crisis, first of all. Daniel answered in verse 15 and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree so hasty from the king? Then Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. So Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom. That word counsel and wisdom is important. The words indicate tact and discretion or inquiry in a careful and guarded way. Exactly what does he say and how he says it? Why is the king's decree so hasty? And it was hasty, and I'm sure the king himself would admit that it was hasty. Some people panic when a crisis strikes. Some come unglued. They can't handle it. Daniel's first response was to ask questions and gather all the facts. And so he asked this question in a careful and a guarded way. Notice he also requests time. Notice what it happens in verse 16. Then Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time and that he would show the king the interpretation. That is the exact same thing that all those other quacks asked for. They said, give us time and we'll come up with an answer. Daniel now comes and requests time. Daniel didn't try to run from the situation, nor did he act in haste. The wording of this verse has all the indications of studied, deliberate action. People often make more trouble for themselves in the midst of crises by acting in haste, making quick, unstudied decisions. Why did the king respond differently to Daniel than to the other wise men of Babylon in verse 8? They asked the king for time also, but Daniel seemed to display a calmness and a confidence while standing before the king. Only a man who knelt in prayer in the presence of God could stand with such confidence before a crazed tyrant monarch. Daniel was a man of prayer. The king must have been curious by Daniel's disposition. Something about the way he carried himself and presented his petition intrigued the king. Just yesterday, the great spiritual leaders of Babylon had panicked in his presence. They had vigorously declared that no man on earth could fulfill the king's demand. Now this young man stands smartly at attention before him and declares with unwavering confidence that he would return with the desired answer to the king's demand if the king would grant him time. Just give me time, king, and I will give you what you're looking for. With a growing curiosity, the king nonchalantly waves his hand to dismiss Daniel, and he gives him a chance. A stern warning rings down the hall as Daniel leaves. You have 24 hours before execution. How much time did the king give him? I know it doesn't say in the text, but in light of what we see later on in the chapter, I suspect that's about all the time he gave him. I'll give you just 24 hours. How many of you have seen some kind of drama like that before, and the person in charge says, you got 24 hours. We don't know for sure how much the king gave him. Can you hear the streets of Babylon, however, buzzing with this exciting gossip? Who is this cocky young Hebrew that thinks he's going to save us all? Why did the king give him time when he refused all the others? I don't care. At least I got 24 hours to live. What do you suppose his plan is? So Daniel shows wisdom in responding to the crisis, in requesting time from the king, and then notice what he does secondly. He requests his prayer meeting. Verse 17 and 18, then Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, his companions, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Daniel's plan was simple and smart. He called a prayer meeting. The best way to respond to a crisis, folks, is first and foremost, pray. Those who are truly wise will seek the God of wisdom. Daniel's diplomacy was asking man for time to ask God for the solution. Blessed are they that keep his testimonies and seek him with a whole heart, David said in Psalm 119, verse 2. Daniel and his companions, it says, would seek the God of heaven. Now, this is a critical statement here. I want you to see that in verse 18, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this. Literally, that means the God of the heavens. This stands in marked contrast to the religious superstitions of the Babylonians who worshiped the actual heavens themselves, the stars and the planets and the galaxies, the starry heavens. Daniel says, we're not going to ask the stars for this. We're not consulting the stars. We're going to consult the one who made the stars. Some people wouldn't or couldn't even pray if their life depended on it. These four young men were in extreme danger, and no doubt their praying took on a renewed fervency in those hours of crisis. Their lives depended on it. Jeremiah 29:13 spoke to this moment, and you will seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart. So many times people in these moments of crisis They say they claim to pray, but they don't really pray with all their heart. They pray for a few minutes and then they go and they do something else and they talk to this person, they do that, and they're going to find solutions in another way. These people found God. This was a vital step in Daniel's diplomacy. He sought the Lord for wisdom. And so Daniel shows great wisdom, and that's the first thing in his diplomacy. It is strong, showing wisdom. Then notice the sweet worship. God answered their prayer in verse 19 through 23. And then what is it? It produces this sweet worship. Notice what happens, verse 19. Then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. So what did Daniel do? He got up and he ran to the king. He said, I got your answer, right? No, the first thing it says, then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. He paused right in that moment. God revealed the answer. And he praised and worshiped God. There's a powerful contrast in verse 19. Daniel's praying apparently continued long into the night because the answer came in a night vision. What a contrast between Nebuchadnezzar's bedroom, verse 1, and Daniel's bedroom. The poor king had great sleep disorders. His spirit was troubled. And without God, folks, the soul becomes troubled over the slightest of matters, even dreams. But with God, the soul is soothed in the most troubling matters, even the threat of execution. Daniel knew that even while the king had commanded his execution, not one hair would fall from his head unless God allowed it. Daniel's bedroom is transformed into a sanctuary of praise as he breaks out into a doxology of worship. Daniel, it says, blessed the God of heaven. This is one of the Bible's most precious doxologies. And we will look at it because it tells us it's a praise chorus. Verses 20 through 23. Verse 20 says, and Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. Daniel's heart was bent on getting close to God. What peace. Christians should remember to thank and bless God when he answers prayer. Notice the crisp, clear theological statements of acknowledging Daniel's doxology. He states that God is the one who changes the times, verse 21, and he changes the times and the seasons. Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 14 goes and tells us there is a time for everything under the sun, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time for this and a time for that. He goes through this whole list of things and times in our lives and the purposes of God. And then in verse 14, he concludes by saying, and nobody can figure it out except God. So that men will fear before God. God is the one that changes the times. He's the one that decides when we're born and when we die. He's the one that decides everything about our lives. He's the one that decides the future. And so Daniel says, the theology in this praise is powerful, it's beautiful. God changes the times and seasons. Secondly, it tells us in verse 21, and he removeth kings and setteth up kings. That goes in line with Psalm 75, 6 and 7. For promotion comes neither from the east nor from the west nor from the south, but God is the judge. He puts down one and he sets up another. Listen, folks, Nebuchadnezzar, Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, Napoleon Bonaparte, Adolf Hitler, Kim Jong-un, Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, Donald Trump, Benjamin Netanyahu, all of these are placed in positions by God like pawns on a chessboard. God is the one that raises up kings and takes them down. He's the one that decides when it's time for that pawn to be sacrificed and to go. The praise chorus, God changes the times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom and knowledge in verse 21. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to those who know understanding. Proverbs 2:6 says, for the Lord gives wisdom. Out of his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. Any wisdom and knowledge we get from anywhere else on the planet must come through this grid of wisdom. He reveals the deep and secret things. He goes on to say in verse 22, he revealed the deep and secret things and knows what is in the darkness, and in the light dwelleth with him. God's mysteries about the past and the future have been deep and secret things, many deep and secret things. Here was a moment in which he was going to reveal something very secretive. God knows everything. You know, that verse became an encouragement to me when I was in high school. I was struggling at one point with my eternal security, and my father pulled out his Bible and he said, let's look at a verse, and he brought me to 1 John chapter 3. And in verse 20, it says, if our heart condemneth, God is greater than our heart and knoweth all things. God knows everything. He knows that day that you called upon him for salvation. He knows everything about us, folks. It's wonderful to know that we have an omniscient God. So there's a praise chorus, and then there's a practical clarification here. It's interesting to see from Daniel what true worship is. In this text, we find that true worship is blessing God, verses 19 and 20. It is praising God in verses 21 and 22. And it is thanking God in verse 23. Blessing God, praising God, thanking God. Now, all of those are kind of connected together, but that is what true worship is. And sometime you might just keep a record, a list of all of the doxologies in the Bible, and there are many. There are many, including several in the book of Revelation. And this one is as great as any of them. It's powerful, it's beautiful, and it's something to remind all of us that we need to be faithful in praising and worshiping God. So we see that Daniel's diplomacy is shown in his wisdom and in his sweet worship, and then finally in his skillful witnessing, verses 24 through 30. Now he comes to the king's court and he gives a confident report. Verse 24, it says, therefore Daniel went into the Arioch, whom the king had ordained to destroy the wise men of Babylon. And he went thus and saith unto them, destroy not the wise men of Babylon. Bring me before the king, and I will reveal unto the king the interpretation. Now, I'm glad it was Daniel that did that. If I'd have gone in there, I said, you know, if you want to kill those guys because they don't know what they're doing, that's probably a good thing. But, he says, spare me, please. But Daniel's interested in sparing all life. Isn't that interesting? I like that. And verse 25, then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste and said thus unto him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation. I think he knows because of the haste that Arioch brought him in haste, it says, that he knows that his time was almost over. And so Daniel, Arioch brings Daniel in with confidence. His life and reputation might also be on the line, by the way. I mean, he's claiming to find someone that can answer, and if he doesn't do it, then maybe Nebuchadnezzar will take his head off too. Who knows? And so he attempts to take the credit. I found a man. Look at this. I found somebody. No, you didn't. Get out of the way, puppet. There's a curious response, verse 26. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belshazzar, art thou able to make known unto me the dream which I have seen and the interpretation of it? The king does not seem to be impressed with Arioch's proud announcement. He seems to ignore Arioch as if to say, get out of the way, you little peon. Let me talk to him. The king is still very much consumed with this whole issue, and he blurts out the nagging question immediately to Daniel. Are you able to do this? This nagging mystery is much like the nagging mystery in the hearts and minds of millions today. Men are searching for the answers to life's puzzling complexities. They're asking like Nebuchadnezzar, do you have the answer? They, like the king, are looking for concrete, clear-cut, concise evidence for reality in the religion ring. Can somebody please show me what is true and right? Daniel gives him a cautious reminder in verse 27. Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, "The secret which the king hath demanded cannot the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers reveal unto the king." His reply first sets the stage to show the stark contrast between truth and error. He reminds the king of the total inability of the world's counselors to satisfy his demands. The king had already arrived at that conclusion, verse 8 through 12, but now Daniel drives that major point home once again. The world's systems cannot give answers, king. Take note of the confidence of Daniel when approaching an opportunity to witness for God. Christians should display that same confidence today. Daniel was coming with a clear, authoritative message of salvation from God. We should witness with the confidence of Daniel. We do have the answer to the world's greatest need. Then he gives them a clearer revelation, verse 28 and 29. But Daniel says in verse 28, "There is a God in heaven." What a statement. There is a God in heaven. That answers the atheists and the agnostics. There is a God in heaven. He is there. There is a God in heaven who revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. That's a phrase we'll see many times throughout the book of Daniel. Highlight it, underline it in red like I did. Make sure you don't forget it. What shall be in the latter days. This isn't just for your days, king. This is something that is for the whole world. Thy dream, he says, and thy visions of thy head upon thy bed are these. As for thee, O king, thy thoughts came into thy mind upon thy bed, what should come to pass hereafter, and he who revealeth secrets maketh known to thee what shall come to pass. This is the first time Daniel witnesses to this pagan king. Daniel didn't talk to him about his religious denomination, Israel. He didn't talk to him about his worship center, the temple. He introduced him to God. Daniel was God's diplomat, a person whose career or profession is diplomacy. Christians today have been given the same profession. 2 Corinthians 5 talks about that. You are ambassadors for Christ. Daniel makes it clear that God was speaking to the king. This may have been more than the dreams which the king had, because he says in that verse, the thoughts of thy head upon thy bed. The thoughts of thy heart may refer to a personal conviction. Daniel simply plants a seed here. He doesn't push for a quick conversion. Now, it's important to note here that Daniel employed a pagan it's important to note that God employed a pagan king as the conduit of his revelation at this particular time. There was only one other time in which this scenario is found, the Egyptian Pharaoh. And both give details about God's plan for the future. We'll see more of that parallel as we move along. Finally, we conclude with a careful restraint in verse 30. A careful restraint. Notice what Daniel says. But as for me, this secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living. I'm no better than John Doe out on the street. I'm no better than the rest of the astrologers. But for their sakes that shall make known the interpretation of the king, and that thou mightest know the thoughts of thy heart. Humility and proper credit marked the message of Daniel. This answer is not from me, O king. This remarkable restraint contrasts the proud attempt of Arioch and others to gain personal honor for undeserved events. Daniel is careful to keep the credit and honor fully upon God. This remarkable humility will continue to shine through the character of Daniel throughout his life. And there it brings us to the dream, which we will look at very carefully next Sunday morning. Well, let's conclude with some application tonight. I have three things. The first one is pray. Instead of panicking, call a prayer meeting. Be faithful in prayer during normal times so that you are well practiced for the moment of crisis. If you are accustomed to praying now, when some crisis comes into your life, then you will pray. If you aren't accustomed to praying now, the crisis will come and you'll turn to the world solutions just like these guys did. Become a person of prayer. The story is told about General George Washington during the Revolutionary War, that one particular day, early in the morning, the soldiers that were on sentry guard, they caught a soldier sneaking off the base. And they immediately arrested him and brought him to the general and said, "We found this man sneaking away." And he was suspected of being a spy. General Washington began to question this young man. He said, "Where were you going?" He said, "I was going to the woods to pray privately." He says, "You were going out to the woods to pray?" He said, "Yes." He said, "Well, let's see how good you are at praying, because your life depends on it right now. Get on your knees and start praying." To which that young soldier responded. He got on his knees and he began to pray fervently and earnestly. And it was obvious after a moment, the general, who knew how to pray himself, said, "Thank you very much. I accept your answer and you're free to go." He said, if you had not been accustomed to praying before this moment, you wouldn't have been able to pray so eloquently and so sincerely. General Washington was a man of prayer himself. Some of you have seen that picture. I have it hanging in my office of General Washington on his knees next to his horse out in the woods himself. He was accustomed to going out in the woods to pray alone. And perhaps this soldier knew it was the same thing that he wanted to do. But what about you? Do you pray? Do you have a regular habit of prayer? If you don't, when the trials come into your life and the crisis comes, you won't turn to prayer and you'll be no better in your prayer time at that point. Pray. Number two, praise. Here is another wonderful doxology. There are multiplied doxologies throughout the scripture. These teach us to faithfully worship and praise our great God. May Jesus Christ be praised in our lives and in our church. That's what we need to do. Pray and praise, and finally preach. That's what Daniel did. He prayed, and God answered his prayers, and he praised, and then he started preaching to the king. Preaching to the king who was trying to take his head off. Witnessing. Daniel was more interested in witnessing to the king than sharing the mysterious prophecies from the dream. If I had that answer in realizing my head was on the line, I might have said, "You know what? Let me tell him the dream first, and then I'll talk to him and try to witness to him about the Lord." Daniel says, "Nope, this is more important. I want you to know where this is coming from, and you need to have a relationship with God." You and I should be greatly concerned with witnessing as well. Pray, praise, and preach. And by the way, what's the best way to pray? Have you ever thought about that? I came across an interesting poem that I'll share with you at this time that tells you how to pray. It's kind of a humorous little poem, but I think it gets a point across too. "The proper way for man to pray," said Deacon Lemuel Keyes, "the only proper attitude is down upon his knees. Nay, I should say the way to pray," said Reverend Dr. Wise, "is standing straight with outstretched arms and rapt upturned eyes." "Oh, no, no, no," said Elder Snow, "such posture is too proud. A man should pray with eyes fast closed and head contritely bowed. It seems to me his hands should be austerely clasped in front, with both thumbs pointing to the ground," said Reverend Dr. Blunt. Never seen that one before. Last year I fell in Hodgkin's well head first, said Cyril Brown, with both my heels a-sticking up, my head a-pointing down. And I done prayed right then and there the best prayer I ever said, the prayingest prayer I ever prayed, a-standing on my head. Folks, if we're praying people, when the crisis comes, we'll be able to pray no matter where we are and what posture we're in and the moment that we need to pray. May God help us to be praying people, praising people, and preaching people.